Welcome to Warships Pod, and with me today is Richard Johnson Bryden, who is a long-time contributor to Warships IFR as a photographer and also as a writer. But more importantly, in the context of what we're going to talk about today, Richard has written books on Royal Navy warships with a special connection to the Royal Family, as they all do, but in particular, the Royal Yacht Britannia, the official book, and also other books with a strong connection, shall we say, between the Royal Navy and the Royal Family on HMS Ocean, the helicopter carrier, and other vessels too. So welcome to the podcast, Richard.
Thank you very much, Ian. Thank you for having me.
And I mean, we're living through momentous times at the moment with the late Her Majesty the Queen, Queen Elizabeth, passing away, or crossing the bar, as they would say in the Navy, and then the accession of King Charles III. And one of the things that I think I'd like to start off with a little bit chronologically is your own direct personal connection, because I understand that one of your relatives was involved in the previous state funeral for a monarch.
Yes, my grandfather had the honour to train the sailors from Chatham who participated in King George VI's funeral. So it's been quite interesting to watch a lot of the preparations that have been going on in the early hours of the morning in London over the last few days to get a little bit of an insight into just what they would have been going through 70 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, it may seem obvious to us because we work in the naval sphere, the naval realm, but to other people, it sometimes is a surprise to see Royal Navy sailors, for example, drawing the gun carriage which will carry the Queen to Westminster Abbey, because they might not quite understand the depth of the connection between the Royal Family and the Navy. But you, through your work, have come to understand that a great deal.
Yeah, in fact, the Royal Family obviously had very strong links and relationship with the armed forces as a whole. As far as the Navy's concerned, the Queen was actually the daughter, the wife, and the mother of naval officers. So she had a very direct insight into what it meant to serve in the Navy, and through her relatives, also what it was like to actually serve in the front line, because her father had served at sea during the First World War, including the Battle of Jutland. Her husband, the Duke of Edinburgh, had actually served in action during the Second World War. And obviously her son, the Duke of York, had served in the Falklands War as a helicopter pilot. So that enabled her to really look sailors in the eye and make that connection in a way that wouldn't have been so easy if she hadn't had that direct personal link.
And the important thing in that connection, when it comes to the Royal Navy and the Royal Family, is that, of course, her father, as you say, had been at the Battle of Jutland. The Duke of Edinburgh was in the Mediterranean at the Battle of Cape Matapan, and also out in the Pacific, where the risk was from the kamikazes. And then Prince Andrew was helicopter pilot in the Falklands War and took some risks himself. So they understand the dangers that the Royal Navy's sailors and Marines go through when they go to defend Queen and country, don't they?
Absolutely. And again, I think that is also valuable when it comes to meeting the families of those serving in the Navy as well. So again, they've got that direct insight into just what they would be going through at times of conflict.
And that comes back to this idea that as Commander-in-Chief, Her Majesty the Queen, the late Queen, and now King Charles III are the boss. They are the boss of the Royal Navy, the Air Force, and the Army. But one particularly special connection, one very obvious connection between the Royal Family and the Royal Navy was, of course, the Royal Yacht Britannia, which was paid off some years ago. And with doing the official book for the Royal Yacht, that must have been quite an experience, because I believe you met the Queen and other of top royals, shall we say, when you were doing that.
Well, I was incredibly lucky to have the opportunity to write the official history. At the timing of my desire to write a book about Britannia coincided with the Queen and the Duke of Edinburgh wanting an official history to be written. And as with so many projects during the Queen's reign, the Duke took the lead on the book on their behalf. And this book was overseen and facilitated through his household. And as a result of that tremendous support, I managed to interview not only the Duke of Edinburgh, but the then Prince of Wales, now obviously King Charles III, Princess Royal, Duke of York, and as well as a wonderful cross-section of those who'd been involved in the yacht's story from from her designer, Sir John Brown, through to the junior yachtsmen, the shipbuilders, all of the surviving flag officer Royal Yachts and the Commodore Royal Yachts, to members of the household and government ministers. And none of that would have been possible without their support. And it was one of the unique claims that the yacht had, that unlike some of the other palaces, there was never, ever a leak. Whatever happened on the yacht stayed on the yacht. And it was a little bit of a culture shock when I was interviewing some of these people that served in the yacht for 20, 30 years. It had always been drilled into them. You never talk to the general public about, and particularly the press, about your experiences in the yacht. Here they were actually being told you could do that, and here was the opportunity to give a good insight into the yacht's role over the years. And then I was lucky enough to actually meet the Queen at the end of the process, because there was a reunion for the Association of Royal Yachtsmen was actually held in St. James's Palace. And it was quite a nice example of how that link between the yachtsmen and the royal family survived the paying off of the yacht. That event was attended by the Queen and Prince Philip, but also a number of other members of the royal family who circulated in the two rooms in St. James's Palace. And it was a wonderful event, clearly enjoyed just as much by members of the royal family as it was by the royal yachtsmen. So it was a wonderful occasion.
The Duke of Edinburgh famously was not somebody who could tolerate fools gladly, I don't think. Had a good sense of humour, a very dry sense of humour, but I think was a fairly, to those that don't know him, you know, was probably quite a daunting prospect to anybody to actually meet. So as he was steering or helping to bring that book to fruition, I mean, were you at all worried that you would get summoned to the captain's table and dressed down for anything? I mean, were you worried about meeting the Duke of Edinburgh or the Queen or any of the others?
Well, I have to say that the Duke was a wonderful person to have the chance to be involved in a project like this with. I found him very, very straightforward to deal with. You would get, when I sent the drafts through for him to read through, make sure I hadn't made any bloopers, you'd get the odd comments back in the margin of, you know, this is table load of rubbish or what have you. And on some of those, I'd come back and say, well, greatest respects, sir, the reason I put this in is because of X, Y, Z. And he would look at that and he would say, okay, I've forgotten about that, you're quite right. Or you may well have found that in the documents, but the bit you're unaware of is this. And then you'd be presented with another paragraph of insight into the background of that event. So, I found it a very constructive process. And in many respects, I think, to understand the Duke, he was very much, from what I saw of him, like a naval officer of his generation. And if he could see that you were trying to do the right thing and you weren't just mucking about, then he would give you his wholehearted support and helpful advice where you did get it wrong. But it was always meant in a constructive manner. It was never a negative or offensive way.
I mean, that's a fine tribute to you, that really is. I know what you mean about a certain generation of Royal Navy officers like you have dealt with quite a few and interviewed them. But presumably you didn't interview the Queen, though. I mean, you didn't really talk to her. That wasn't the sort of thing you did.
Sadly, I didn't get the chance to interview the Queen. I think that was partly probably down to the fact that because there was so much ground to cover for the yacht, the point at which I might have been able to have had that opportunity, we were already rushing up to the deadline for the yacht's end. Golden Jubilee, and that was one of the cardinal points of the project, was if humanly possible, that book needed to be published to coincide with the 50th anniversary of the yacht.
Which was when? What year was that?
That was 2003, so that was May 2003.
Right, so was there any kind of special launch for it, where you got to present a copy of this book to them, and was there any special arrangements for that?
Well, I was, again, very lucky. I had the opportunity to present the first copy of the limited edition to the Queen at the reunion at the Association of the Yachtsmen, which was held at St. James's Palace. And then a matter of days later, the actual launch was held also in St. James's Palace and hosted by the Duke of Edinburgh himself, who had quite an interesting time going around the room and talking to the various guests, which included a number of officers who'd actually served in the yacht. At the end of the process, because all these royal events run to quite a rigid timetable, the person who actually runs the royal apartments in the St. James's was giving me a gentle nudge that we needed to get on for the Duke to give his speech, because he was deep in conversation with two of the admirals he'd commanded the yacht. And I thought, well, I think if you want to interrupt the Duke, you carry on. I'm certainly not going to, to do so. And we got away with it, and it all went very well.
And did you have special editions to present to them? I mean, I can't imagine that they would want anything but the best kind of quality or something that was notable.
Well, actually, the standard version, I thought, was probably the better one, because it had the painting that used to hang in the Royal Drawing Room in the yacht. And that was actually specifically at the instigation of the Duke, because I asked his opinion as to what he thought would be on the cover. And he said, well, why don't you put that on? And that was a very, very generous and helpful suggestion. There was a special limited edition with a leather binding, and I managed to ensure that the Queen was presented with book number one, and then we followed the order of precedence from thereafter to also give copies to other members of the royal family who'd kindly contributed to the project.
So the Duke of Edinburgh got what, number two?
So he had number two. The Prince of Wales, now King, had book number three, and I think the Duke of York had number four, and then the Princess Royal had number five.
So you wouldn't want to get that in the wrong order, would you?
It was absolutely the order of precedence. So, absolutely. Yeah,
brilliant. Well, that's fantastic. Well, thanks for that. But there was another ship which, there are many ships that the Queen has had special association with, and I've not been aboard, or I didn't get the chance to go aboard the Royal Yacht Britannia. I was lucky enough to go and see a fair few fleet reviews from Royal Navy warships that the Queen was present at in 1994 for D-Day, which was a fleet procession as well across the Channel to off the D-Day beaches. And I also saw the Queen reviewing the fleet during the 2003 fleet colour presentation. I was on board a frigate for that. And we, as the magazine, we've had people at the 2003 fleet review, if you like, the colour presentation at Plymouth, and then at a massive one, the Trafalgar 200 one, where the Queen reviewed the international fleet. But it was during the 1994 D-Day events that I was put aboard a Type 21 frigate with a photographer when I was a newspaper reporter, and I was lucky enough to sit on top of the bridge of the frigate alongside one of the sons of Admiral Ramsay, the man who actually planned the D-Day invasion from the naval side. And we were the guardship of the Royal Yacht Britannia, and sailed across behind that amazing ship. And at one point in the channel, we passed down between two lines of warships representing the Allied nations, astern of the Britannia, and a Lancaster flew over and dropped poppies, etc., etc. But the one amusing story I have, I think, connected with the Queen there, which I filed to my newspaper, was that when it got to the ship, got to off Wistrom, which was Sword Beach in 1944, there was a yacht in the way. And this yacht refused to move out the way of the Royal Yacht Britannia. And I was sort of reading the signals because I was on the bridge, I think, of the Type 21 frigate, what was going on. And this yacht was saying, I'm not getting out of the way. I'm going up the lock and into the Caen Canal before you. And they said, excuse me, but this is the Queen on board the Royal Yacht Britannia, and you've got to get out of the way, mate. And he did, but it is a good story. And I did see the Queen at a Royal film performance, because I had another job about 20 years ago for a while as a scriptwriter for a company in London. And we did a charity film that was shown to the Queen before the main film at the Royal film performance in 2004. So, I mean, that is as close, apart from as a newspaper reporter covering various other walkabouts and things by the Royals, that's as close as I ever came to her. But you met the Queen again, I think, or you were in close company with her when she was aboard HMS Ocean, the helicopter carrier, I believe.
Well, that's right. That was for the paying off ceremony in 2018. And that was a very happy event. The ship's company really appreciated the fact that the Queen had travelled all the way down to Devonport and spent the morning with them. And after the actual ceremony itself, she was driven on board and then came down on the lift into the hangar, where there was a reception for members of the ship's company and their families. And she spent probably about an hour or so making her way around the hangar. Bear in mind, she would have been 92 at that stage. Very happily chatting with everybody she met, and I was lucky enough to be amongst those people who met her. And, it was a very happy occasion.
That was because you wrote the decommissioning book for the ship, wasn't it?
Yes, which covered her rich history from the design through to her last deployment.
And as the in that context, as the lady sponsor of the vessel, I believe.
Yes, she was the lady sponsor. And in fact, a slight twist of fate, actually. Normally, the lady sponsor actually names the ship at the point of launch. But because of the contractual arrangements for the construction of the ocean, that vessel which owned the shipyard in Barrow acted as prime contractor. And they subcontracted the construction of the hull and machinery to Caverna in Devon. But they didn't want Caverna to have all the prestige of a royal launch. So to resolve the dilemma of not having the Queen launch the ship, the MOD project manager for the helicopter carrier team decided that the honour should fall to the longest-serving female member of the team. So Mrs. Jane Chambers had that honour, and an ocean was eventually moved round to Barrow and fitted out, and on the 20th of February 1998, the Queen was invited to come and name her ship. And that was the start of a very happy association, which carried through to the end of her time in service. And she would visit, on average, about every 2 to 3 years, depending on the ship's programme and obviously her commitments. And that was greatly appreciated by everybody who was present on those visits.
And, of course, the most prominent warship of the current era that the Queen had special connection to well, they say in name, but I'm not sure if it is actually in name, is HMS Queen Elizabeth. But I believe she's named after the first Queen Elizabeth, not
yes,
the current one. But that kind of confuses me, because I remember I went to interview Alan West, Lord West, as he is now Admiral West, when he was first Sea Lord. And he explained to me how way back in the early 2000s, they had, the Royal Navy that is, had decided to name the two carriers HMS Queen Elizabeth and HMS Prince of Wales straight away, or as early as they could in the build process, because they were afraid that if they didn't do that and put a prominent name on the vessels, then they could be cancelled. So his ploy, which he explained actually in an interview in Warships IFR at the time, was to, he didn't call it a ploy, of course, was to name the vessels Queen Elizabeth and Prince of Wales. And then if the government tried to cancel the carriers to save money, had a change of mind about these massive ships, then they would find it very, very, very embarrassing to cancel them and then have to answer to the Queen and obviously then Prince Charles, Prince of Wales, as to why they'd torpedoed these fine vessels.
Their ships. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. So that would have been very, very embarrassing. But you were at the commissioning of one of the carriers, though, weren't you, where you saw the Queen again?
That was HMS Prince of Wales. Because, again, I'd had the opportunity to write the commissioning book. The lady sponsor for Prince of Wales is the former Duchess of Cornwall, now Queen Consort. And, again, she attended the commissioning ceremony in Portsmouth, which was probably the last great naval occasion before the pandemic. And it was attended by a host of the key figures that have been involved throughout the construction of the carriers from the outset in the late 90s through to 2019. As well as all of the surviving former First Sea Lords.
I was asked recently by somebody, and it's a perfectly valid question if you don't know much about the Navy or you're not a historian, if HMS Prince of Wales would now have her name or the name changed to HMS Prince Charles, because the Prince of Wales, the current Prince of Wales, has been promoted to King Charles. So I suppose people are slightly mystified by the naming of ships and how the process comes out. But in the case of Queen Elizabeth and Prince of Wales, those were two distinguished names which had ships of the past that had actually notched up a record for Queen Elizabeth at the Dardanelles in World War One and then in World War Two. But for Prince of Wales, famously, a battleship that fought the Bismarck and then did the Malta convoys, carried Churchill to America, and then was unfortunately sent on a crazy mission to try and save Singapore and was sunk there. But the names themselves, regardless of the monarch and the prince or whichever member of the royal family it is, endure and live on, don't they? So,
absolutely. Yeah. And in fact, both of those names were actually chosen for the ill-fated fixed-wing carriers of the 1960s.
Oh, were they?
the ship that's forever known as by her NATO designation as CBA-01 would have been named Queen Elizabeth. The second one would have been Prince of Wales, and then there was a projected third ship would have been Duke of Edinburgh.
Right. I mean, that is true. I mean, back in the late 60s, just in case some listeners don't know too much about it, there was the previous carrier program, which was going to build these, I think, 50,000-ton carriers, and it was poleaxed by defence cuts, or they were poleaxed by defence cuts. And so, as you say, they never happened. And I suppose that gave people like Admiral West, Admiral Lord West, the idea that we better move on from just calling them, I can't remember what the current carriers were called, but whatever the number was, CVF, Carrier Vessel Future.
CVF, wasn't it?
To give them a name, because then probably somebody will think twice about cutting them.
Well, there was a lovely story about the choice of naming as well, because Admiral Slater, who was the first Sea Lord during the SDR, which actually led to the authorisation of the carriers, was telling me that in the, again, similar point, you needed to name ships as early as possible. And they rather jokingly suggested they ought to be HMS Tony Blair and Gordon Brown to ensure they actually survived the political process.
Well, of course, in places like America, they do name carriers after presidents, national leaders. And that's why we have the John F. Kennedy and Harry S. Truman and things like that. But I don't think there's yet been one named after a prime minister. There probably have been warships named after prime ministers. Certainly the submarine Churchill during the Cold War, an attack submarine, was named after Winston Churchill. But in the current era, I don't think there's any plans to name a politician, or rather name a ship.
There'll be much appetite for that at the moment.
There's no plans to name a ship after a politician. But there is going to be another a first, HMS King George VI, which will be a ballistic missile submarine. But where do you think the future for the Royals and the Navy lies? I mean, obviously, the new Prince of Wales, William, is the Commodore-in-Chief of the Submarine Service, and Princess Anne is an Admiral as well. So there are other people, Princess Royal, to use a proper title. So there are people already within that setup who have a connection with the Royal Navy. But do you see it carrying on as healthily as it is right now?
Oh, absolutely. You'll actually see the new generations stepping into some of those roles that perhaps were previously occupied by the late Queen. I mean, the most notable one, of course, is what will happen to the role of Lady Sponsor for Queen Elizabeth. If you look at the precedent of the Invincible-class carriers, for Illustrious, when Princess Margaret died, that role of Lady Sponsor was taken on by her daughter, Lady Sarah Chatto, very successfully. And although you can only have one Lady Sponsor for per ship, so she was known by the title of Ship's Friend. So perhaps it might be quite fitting, knowing that the carriers will be in service for 50 years or so, it might be a rather nice thought, perhaps, for the new Princess of Wales to become the next Ship's Friend for Queen Elizabeth, to again give that sort of continuity for ship's companies going forward in the traditional sponsor role.
I'm sure they'd be delighted with that. That'd be brilliant.
No, I mean, one of the interesting things about the Queen's relationship with the Royal Navy is the number of interesting ships she had the opportunity to launch, starting off with the last of the Royal Navy's battleships, HMS Vanguard, in 1944. Which, of course, she subsequently went on to spend time at sea when she was used for the Royal Tour to South Africa in 1947. She also launched the mighty aircraft carrier HMS Eagle in 1946, again as a young princess, before going on to launch Royal Yacht Britannia, the nuclear submarine HMS Dreadnought. I presume she would have launched the fated carrier CVO-1 had she been built and named Queen Elizabeth as planned. But she did go on to launch the Type 42 destroyer HMS Sheffield, which was so sadly lost in the Falklands War, as well as the aircraft carrier Invincible, which served in the Falklands War as well. HMS Lancaster, the current Type 23 frigate, which is known as the Queen's Frigate. And the reason she launched HMS Lancaster is that the monarch has held the title Duke of Lancaster since 1399. HMSation we've already discussed. And then more recently, of course, the fleet flagship HMS Queen Elizabeth, which she named in Rosyth in 2014.
It's been great to discuss the Queen, the Royal Family and the Royal Navy. Brilliant. And I think as we finish, it'd be worth just thinking about what will happen or what is happening in London, because there are going to be more than 1,000 sailors and Royal Marines there. And it'll be quite something to see those young men and women lining the route or routes and also pulling the carriage, controlling the carriage that carries the Queen as well during those momentous events. But circling back a little bit to gain some insight into things, I want to just come back to your granddad. And I know you're a very modest chap and you probably don't want to highlight this close family connection, but I think it's quite fascinating to people who are watching an act, a mission, let's say, for the Royal Navy. It's very much the same. I mean, it is identical to the one that was performed in 1952 for King George VI and also for Winston Churchill, who I think was the last person to get such a funeral, state funeral in the UK. So what did your grandfather actually do? I mean, was he in charge of that gun carriage, the same gun carriage that we're going to see or we're seeing taken?
Well, he was actually training the sailors. I think the actual officer responsible was a captain, if I remember rightly. And if you look at the photographs, he's on one side of the sailors behind the coffin, and on the other side is unbeknown to me at the time when I started my work on the book about the Fourth Admiral, was a Commander Pollock, who subsequently went on to command the Royal and become First Sea Lord. I know from, although my grandfather never spoke too much about these things, it certainly was a highlight of his career, and I'm sure it will be for everybody who's involved in all of the ceremonial events that we've seen and will see as part of the funeral for the Queen. And if you look at the standard of those events that we've already seen in Scotland, everybody has performed to the highest standards, and it's remarkable that the lack of time that they've had to prepare for such high-profile and important duties. I mean, you think the people in Scotland had a matter of days to prepare for that, and obviously the people who are going to be involved in Monday's funeral have been training hard in the early hours of the morning with their dress rehearsals. And again, they've only had just over a week to prepare for that role. So it is incredible, and it's something which the armed forces, once again, have very much risen to the occasion. And we would hope that the Queen would be looking down with pride on what they have achieved.
Well, that's a brilliant way to end the podcast. So thank you very much for that. And it was great having you on, Richard.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a great pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Warships Pod, and for more on the momentous events in London and elsewhere regarding the passing of the Queen, Queen Elizabeth II, and also the accession of King Charles III, the Royal Navy and the Royal Family, then please check out Warships IFR.